The burning occurred in a house that's next door to us.
That's historian Anthony Wunderly. And the burning he refers to took place in 1947. Ellen Whalen-Smith picks up the story from there.
For myself, growing up, we always knew that it had happened. And, you know, as I say in my book, it was like a family secret. Everybody knew it had happened, but nobody talked about it. And if you would ask people, nobody would ever, you know, sort of admit or, you know, allude to who might have called for it or why at that particular moment. But in any case, what it was basically the entire archive of the Oneida community. They kept meticulous documents about everything that they did, all their diaries, all their letters, all their publications, all their sort of internal, you know, memos and so forth that were not for public consumption. All the papers were taken out and burned. I mean, nobody could ever figure out why 1947, you know, what was it about this time? And it was actually Tony Wunderly who first, when I spoke to him before I wrote the book and, you know, sort of probed him on why this, do you have any hunches as to why this would have been a time when they burned it? And he suggested that it might have been in anticipation of the 100th year anniversary of Oneida Silverware, which they were going to be celebrating in rather, you know, sort of extravagant and public fashion, and that maybe that had something to do with it.
Again, Anthony Wunderly.
What I next hear is a company official telling a researcher named Kephart, who wrote a book about extraordinary societies, but included Oneida, and was interviewing people in, I think, the early 60s around here. And he talked to one person who was a company official at that point and also a descendant. And the guy said, yeah, so we had all these papers, and I told the company, you know, there's a lot of embarrassing stuff in it, and we made the decision to load them into a truck. And he states there was a lot of it, and we took it out and burned it. And the idea seems to have been that the company did not want, at that point in time, I think it was 1947, to be associated with the notion of old Oneida community sex, that they thought that was not in keeping with the company emphasis on selling silverware at that point.
I'm Dan Greenstone, and this is the American Utopia podcast. How should we remember Oneida? That's the question we'll try to answer in this, the final episode of American Utopia. Ever since the commune ended, the attitudes of the communards and their descendants towards Oneida's legacy have oscillated. At times, there's been a warm nostalgia for communal living. But at other times, as we just heard, in the case of the burning, there's been embarrassment and even violent hostility to the memory of the Oneida experiment. And actually, this ambivalence about how to make sense of this extraordinary, but in many ways troubling, place existed even while the commune still operated, especially in its final years. Terza Miller was a central figure in the Oneida community's final decade. She grew up at Oneida, and she was the niece and favorite lover of John Humphrey Noyes, the community's charismatic founder. She was also deeply involved in the Oneida community's artistic and literary life, including the community orchestra and as the editor of the weekly newspaper. And yet, as Ellen Whalen-Smith, a descendant of Noyes and a historian of the Oneida community, explained to me, even Terza Miller had deep, deep doubts about the community that was the only life she'd ever known.
And, you know, even Terza Miller has a moment in her diary, which was very painful for me to read, because she records how one time she's sitting in a room listening to John Humphrey Noyes talk, and all of a sudden she gets this cold, she goes into a cold sweat, and she's looking at him as though she were an outsider looking at him for the first time. And she says, "My God, what if he is just a madman and he's fooled us into this entire thing?"
Terza Miller's question is really the same question that drew me to this subject, the question that got me to spend the last year immersed in life at Oneida. It's the reason I started this podcast. As we've documented in our previous seven episodes, Life at Oneida was chock full of contradictions. It was vibrant and fun, erotic and interesting, and filled with camaraderie. But it was also in some ways narrow and strict, controlling, and even painful. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this question and talking about it with the historians who know Oneida best. And in this, our final episode, I will share some of what these historians have said and my own thoughts as well. But how did Tirza Miller answer her own question about whether John Humphrey Noyes was a madman experimenting on the rest of the communards? Again, here's Ellen Wayland Smith.
She decided it was an evil spirit who was whispering that to her, that it wasn't true. But that, you know, talk about like the cult experience, right? She has this moment of sort of lucidity where like she wonders what reality is.
And they were active sexual partners.
Oh yeah. And that was her uncle. And it was basically her sort of de facto father because her father had died when she was an infant. So to doubt him would have been, you know, was serious. And yet she had this moment where she was like, is he crazy? I think there were those elements.
When Ellen Wayland Smith says those elements, she's talking about whether Oneida had the elements of a cult. And as you heard, her answer is basically yes. But interestingly, it took her a long, long time to arrive at that conclusion. She told me the story of how she got there.
No, I was raised basically, you know, whenever I asked about who my ancestors were, I was told they started a utopian community where they believed that, all men were equal and we had to share and that, you know, it was this sort of noble, almost enlightenment experiment in communism. And most of the sexual aspect and the religious aspect were left out of it. So, you know, the first time, the word cult never arose. It was never presented to me as a cult. But the first time I encountered that was with this German teacher who I told the story of Oneida to one time, just by accident or by serendipity. And he said, "Oh, that sounds that sounds exactly like the Branch Davidians in Waco." And I couldn't believe it. It never occurred to me that these were in any way comparable movements. And I think, you know, first of all, that one of the reasons that I had never thought of them in comparable movements is that the more I think about it, growing up and, you know, when I reflect on the community, people have talked about the sexual aspect of it and the sexual sharing, and there were even sort of jokes about it and so forth. That seemed tolerable, that we should talk about our ancestors as having been swingers. What was intolerable was talking about our ancestors as having been religious fanatics. It was almost as though, you know, my grandmother's generation, they were less embarrassed by the sexual freedoms and, you know, horrified by the religious fanaticism. And so I never, you know, I don't think I even ever heard it described as a Christian experiment, when in fact that's deeply what it was. So, you know, the more I studied when I was writing this book, the more I looked into it, the more I was shocked by the extent to which you couldn't understand it without the Christian background. And no, I do think there are similarities to the Branch Davidians. I mean, certainly, you know, the idea of investing divine authority in a single leader, of allowing that leader to dictate sort of sexual arrangements and to, you know, get the first dibs on the sexual spoils.
For those who remember the Branch Davidians, this comparison may seem forced or extreme. The Branch Davidians were an offshoot of the Davidian Seventh-day Adventists, who were a group that got their start in New York's burned-over district, right around the same time as Oneida, during the Second Great Awakening. And the Branch Davidians had split from the main Davidians, that's why they're called Branch. But, like the main Davidian group, as well as many other religious groups, they believed that the end days were near and that Jesus' second coming was at hand. And by 1993, the Branch Davidians were living in a compound outside of Waco, Texas, led by a charismatic leader named David Koresh. And Koresh claimed to be God's final prophet. But he'd attracted the attention of law enforcement because of rumors, which proved to be true, that he was in possession of huge numbers of weapons. When the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms tried to execute a warrant to search for weapons at the compound, there was a shootout in which several agents and several Davidians were killed. And the Davidians refused to surrender. After that, the FBI took over from the ATF. And the FBI was able to negotiate the release of 19 children. But their interviews with the children revealed that Koresh was a serial child abuser and pedophile. Still, the Davidians would not surrender. And they were heavily armed and extremely well-prepared and had enough provisions to withstand a long siege. After 51 days, using military-grade weapons, the FBI made a final assault on the compound. Here's a clip from CBS News back in 1993 that explains what happened.
This is a CBS News special report. Vicki Mabry has been standing by in Waco, Texas for the entire duration of the standoff. She joins us now live. Vicki, what can you tell us about this fire?
John, just about 5 minutes ago, we saw tanks continuing to batter the compound, continuing to put gaping holes into the walls of the structure. We saw what looked like white, wispy smoke coming out, which usually is indicative of tear gas. The FBI has told us that they are using non-lethal tear gas to try to flush cult members out. And then suddenly, out of one of the second floor windows, flames burst forth. And as you can see, it looks like at this point like the entire compound is just engulfed in flames.
In the end, 76 branch Davidians, including more than 20 children, died during the confrontation. While some of the surviving members argued that the FBI was responsible for the conflagration, the evidence indicates that the branch Davidians set the fires themselves and committed suicide en masse after Koresh was killed. This kind of tragic and violent ending is probably what most Americans picture when they think of the word cult. And so, while I see what Ellen Wayland Smith and her German teacher mean when they call Oneida a cult and compare it to the Branch Davidians, I confess that I find the comparison unsettling. I asked some other historians if they thought Oneida was a cult. Christian Goodwillie is the director of special collections at Hamilton College, and he has a slightly different take.
Do you use the word cult?
Sure.
Was Oneida a cult?
Well, so I do use the word cult, and I don't really have a problem with it, but I would call Catholicism a cult. I would call any kind of religion a cult, you know? So in that case, yeah. I guess I don't use it as a pejorative. It's a sect. Cult, a sect, you know. To me, it's all the same.
So, a couple things here. I take Christian's point. All religions are, in some sense, a cult. And there's a real simplicity to this logic that's kind of appealing. If you're a scholar of religion, like Christian is, it must be really helpful to not have to discriminate between different groups and draw lines that are inevitably going to be arbitrary. So, I get it. All religions are cults. But in the end, I'm not sure how helpful that is in trying to make sense of Oneida. I think where I land is that Oneida obviously shared some features with cults like the Branch Davidians. But in the end, the comparison just isn't fair. The Branch Davidian experiment ended in mass murder and suicide, while Oneida voted peacefully to dissolve itself. And while the transition into mainstream society was challenging for Oneida members, the truth is they managed it fairly seamlessly. Indeed, former members and their descendants turned the old commune into a responsible, progressive, and highly profitable silverware business that lasted more than a century. Nobody went to jail, and nobody died. So perhaps a better way to think about Oneida is to ask whether they achieved their goals. And to understand what they were hoping to achieve, I think we should pull back just a bit and give some context. Oneida was one of many Christian groups that theologians describe with the word millennial. And millennial essentially means that the second coming of Christ is near. This is why some groups use the term end days. And millennial groups also believe that there will be a kingdom of God on earth, which lasts 1,000 years, hence the term millennial. And this was a very common belief during the Second Great Awakening, particularly in the burnt-over district of New York, which was home to Oneida. For example, one of Noyce's rivals was a man named William Miller, who is the founder of the Seventh-day Adventists, which I guess makes him sort of the great-grandfather of the Branch Davidians. And Miller, who, like Noyce, was from Western New England and then later moved to New York, was essentially a numerologist who, after a heavy study of the Bible, concluded that he had calculated the date for Jesus' second coming. In 1821, he wrote up his findings, declaring, "I believe that the second coming of Jesus Christ is near, even at the door, even within 21 years, on or before 1843. As the date drew near, Miller began lecturing. In fact, his first speech on the subject was in 1831, the same year that Noyce was converted at a revival. And Miller's ideas quickly spread, and he gathered a huge following that is estimated to be between 50 and 500,000 people. And yeah, that is a pretty wide range, but even at the low end, it's a lot of people. Miller had refused to set a specific date, but he promised that the second coming would happen sometime between March 1843 and March of 1844. And when the final date came and went, without any appearance by Jesus, he was chastened. "I confess my error," he wrote, "and acknowledge my disappointment. Yet I still believe that the day of the Lord is near, even at the door." And one of Miller's followers revisited his calculations and showed that he'd made a slight error. In fact, the date of Jesus' second coming could now be precisely predicted. It was October 22nd, 1844. And so thousands of Millerites, some wearing special white robes, waited for the end of the world on hillsides and in churches. But, spoiler, the sun rose and Jesus didn't come. One of Miller's followers, Hiram Edson, recorded his thoughts, which honestly are kind of heartbreaking. "Our fondest hopes and expectations were blasted," he wrote, "and such a spirit of weeping came over us as I never experienced before. We wept and wept till the day dawned. Has the Bible proved a failure? Is there no God, no heaven, no golden home city, no paradise? Is all this but a cunningly devised fable? Is there no reality to our fondest hope and expectation of these things?" This event became known as the Great Disappointment. And so was Oneida also a great disappointment? In some ways, it has to be considered one, at least if we judge it by the standards its founders set for themselves. And to understand why, it's important to clarify where the Oneidans disagreed with William Miller. Noyce and his followers believed that Jesus had already reappeared way back in AD 70, when the Romans destroyed the Jewish temple in Jerusalem. And while Noyce agreed with Miller that there would be a kingdom of God on earth, he was much more ambitious in some ways. Rather than waiting passively on hillsides for it to appear, Noyce believed that humans needed to actively construct it, and who better to do so than himself? As Chris Jennings writes in his book, Paradise Now, what made Noyce a utopian rather than a raving seer like William Miller was that he combined these supernatural beliefs about the end of history with a highly practical plan for realizing his vision. And I'd make a similar point, but I'd put it this way. The whole premise of Oneida, at least theologically speaking, was Noyce's belief that the traditional laws and customs of sex, marriage, love, and commerce were for fallen people, pre-second coming people. In this way, Noyce saw himself as the spiritual heir of St. Paul, who argued successfully that Christians no longer had to follow the laws of the Torah. Similarly, the laws of the United States, according to Noyce, did not apply to the Oneida perfectionists. The laws that consecrated marriage and private property, and those banning adultery and pedophilia, these laws just didn't need to be used by saints. So, if the question is, did Oneida achieve its goal of breaking free from societal norms and living in the communal style that Noyce had sketched out? I think the answer is yes. For most of its three decades, the community functioned fairly harmoniously. And this was a truly remarkable achievement, one worth highlighting and appreciating. But living communally wasn't their only goal. Noyes, like other utopian founders, saw his community as a beacon for others to follow. He believed he was charting a path forward. The plan, as Chris Jennings puts it, was, quote, to build a single small utopia, a seminal prototype of the coming paradise. Its example would be so appealing that others would rapidly imitate it. Eventually, the entire world would take up the new system. Presto, heaven on earth. This, of course, did not happen. Even Noyes, in his final days, essentially admitted as much. In a letter to an admirer, he noted that he had failed to carry communism through to final visible success amid the temptations and enmities of this evil world. Or, put another way, in its final few divisive and fraught years, it was the world that changed Oneida, not the other way around. And yet, it's kind of ridiculous to judge Oneida on whether its most outsized ambitions were achieved, or on whether the community was able to transform the country and the whole world. Instead, it seems like a fair test to ask whether the people there were by and large happy. And in particular, I've wondered if the kind of restrictions the community had on special or sticky love were simply too much for mere mortals to live under. I asked Anthony Wunderly for his view on this.
I guess it just seems to me that it's asking a lot of human nature. I feel like we're wired, like physiologically wired, to form, you know, strong.
Giants once walked here, Dan.
Say more about that. What do you mean?
These people may have created, may have come closest to a human created utopia on Earth, closer than any other group. And those ideals were passed along at least for another 50 years. Some amazing idealism occurred here that was acted out and achieved.
I asked Christian Goodwillie if he thought the communards of Oneida were happy.
Well, that's a really good question. I think it was successful on many fronts, and I think there were many people that had good experiences here. And when you read the memoirs that survive, for the most part, the people, even in close family relationships that had a sexual aspect to them, they were enjoying themselves, it does seem. So yeah, I think it was successful. And I think that it's some evidence of its success is the cohesiveness of the descendants of this community when the community broke up and their roles in the Oneida Limited and their houses all being near where we are at the Mansion House, and the fact that many of them returned to live in the Mansion House, and, you know, generations on today, they're still close as descendants. So I think they forged a real bond.
I asked Ellen Whalen Smith a version of the same question.
So Spencer Claw, mm-hmm. The very end of his excellent book, mm-hmm. he says this, and I want your reaction to it. He says, it is impossible to contemplate the collapse of Noyes' daring scheme for human betterment without a stabbing sense of loss. Do you feel that same sense of loss?
I don't feel that same sense of loss. I think it was unsustainable. At the best oppressive, at the worst coercive. I don't think it was something that could have lasted.
On one level, Ellen Whalen Smith is clearly right to flag the oppression and coercion at Oneida. In previous episodes, we've chronicled in detail the troubling aspects of life there. All of the incest and pedophilia, and Noyes' authoritarian impulses, which at times made life miserable for some of the inhabitants, perhaps especially for young women. On the other hand, I think it's important to be clear about our point of comparison. It makes little sense to contrast Oneida with how we live now. It was a product of its times. And while there's no doubt that the coerced sex that took place there, particularly of young girls, is appalling, it's worth remembering that this sort of coercion at Oneida, while different, was probably no worse than that of ordinary American women. Remember, the concept of marital rape was decades and decades in the future. And as we've documented throughout this series, compared to other American females, Oneida women had vastly more educational, occupational, and leadership opportunities, as well as much more sexual fulfillment. In any case, in assessing Oneida's legacy, drilling too deeply into the details is a little beside the point, because the question isn't should we reconstitute the Oneida community today exactly as it was in the 1860s. And that's a ridiculous idea, which literally no one is proposing. Instead, I think it makes more sense to consider their approach to social organization. And I do believe that approach was fruitful. The first thing to recall is that the norms for how we live and love change, and they've never been stable. Family structure, marriage, sex, all of it evolves. Indeed, much of the social conservative movement is based on the myth that there was some golden age of family, which they often pinpoint as being in the 1950s. But that 1950s home, with its mothers raising big bunches of kids in the suburbs while the dad goes to work, that was a one-off anomaly. And if you're listening to this podcast, odds are that you wouldn't vote to undo the changes of the 1960s and 70s, which included reliable birth control and the women's liberation movement. Only this most severe social conservative would roll back these advances, because doing so would mean reinstituting the patriarchy, binding women to their fertility, and undermining the hard-won economic independence that women have begun to achieve over the last five decades. And it would also mean reversing the remarkable sexual freedom that we've come to take for granted, as well as trapping people in unhappy or abusive or even dangerous marriages. This unprecedented expansion in individualism and personal freedom has also brought in its wake an array of unsettling changes. Here are a few: delayed and less frequent marriage, spiking divorce rates, a huge increase in single parenthood, and a remarkable, truly world historically unprecedented number of people who describe themselves as lonely. I think only the most strident partisan or polemicist would say that these changes are either wholly positive or wholly negative. If you, like me, are a feminist, you surely think, on balance, that the changes are worth it. But let's be honest, there have been losers as well as winners, and the truth is that these developments have been sudden, surprising, and unpredictable. They've outpaced our ability to think clearly about them, let alone plan for them. And so we as a society have never had a particularly thoughtful conversation about the benefits, the costs, the consequences of how we live now. And given the state of our politics and the heat of our culture wars most of the time, it seems like a rational and calm debate isn't even remotely possible anymore. So we're left with some not fully appealing choices. You can go along with the individualistic, egalitarian ethos, but we're plunging ahead into the unknown, improvising as we go and then rationalizing after the fact to account for all the social changes we've seen in this last half century. Or if you're a traditionalist, then you can try fighting a doomed rearguard action against changes that you can't possibly stop. And you're probably willfully blind to the limitations and injustices of the supposed golden age that you hearken back to. And so what I want to say is this: the period that gave birth to Oneida was at least as turbulent as our own. We talked about this in episode 3 with historian Stephanie Kuntz. And what makes Oneida remarkable is that these people were neither scolds nor just content to surf the wave of social change. They managed to both agree that the past was regressive and limiting, while also seeing that hurtling forward without any forethought was problematic too. And so they built a structure that they believed maximized individual freedom and happiness within a group context. It's true that the structure wasn't perfect, and its foundation, which was based on John Humphrey Noyce's charisma, wasn't stable. When he lost his magnetism, the whole edifice crumbled. But two or three decades of happiness and relative harmony is not nothing. The Oneidans had the courage to question, to examine, and then to forge their own alternative and incredibly daring path, however imperfect. And that's how I think they should be remembered.
I talked about this with Joe Velasky, who's a retired history teacher and a docent at the Oneida Community Mansion House Museum.
I'll tell you a very quick personal story. So my grandmother was a German-Jewish immigrant, and she grew up in Frankfurt.
Okay.
And she was actually part of the Frankfurt School, and so, like, was really in the Bohemian edge of Europe between the wars.
Okay.
And so I remember when Clinton got impeached, she says to me, "Daniel, I will never understand you Americans. You are such Puritans." So he has an affair.
Right.
"The sexual revolution came in the 1920s where I lived. Your grandfather, me, we all took lovers." So she says this to me, and I have this very strange feeling of being feeling much more straight and narrow and conservative than my own grandmother, which is not a common feeling for American teenagers, right?
Right.
And so I'm wondering if you, or maybe the guests that you take around, ever have that feeling about these people who were so daring and taboo-breaking, but we don't normally associate that with the musty past, you know?
I find it personally admirable to be daring and to be innovative and progressive. I think there's many, many things we can learn. I think we can learn to be more creative than we are. And that and we have the power to do that. And this is such a helpful experience, and it is to me, and I would hope anyone who takes a tour, that there are people who dare to ask these questions and then go one step further than asking them, actually do it.
I want to thank the many people who sat for interviews for this podcast, including Molly Jessup, Joe Velasky, Lawrence Foster, Stephanie Kuntz, Anthony Wunderlich, and Ellen Whalen-Smith. The last two of those, Anthony Wunderlich and Ellen Whalen-Smith, have recent books about Oneida, and I've put links to their books in the show notes. And this podcast wouldn't have been possible without the generous cooperation of the wonderful folks at the Oneida Community Mansion House Museum. The Mansion House is well worth visiting, and it even has a really nice hotel you can stay in. And thanks so much to you for listening. This podcast was completely DIY, and so if you've enjoyed it, please do share it out on social media and rate it in the iTunes store. It helps us find a bigger audience. And if you have any feedback, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me at dangreenstone@yahoo.com. Yeah, I'm still rocking that Yahoo email address.